You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network.
Hey, so this is actually a very special episode because my guest for the day just didn't show up. It didn't even cancel, and I have nothing against that. I have been known to not show up for things at the last minute, and sometimes people are busy, and sometimes people forget things, and sometimes people are rude, but they know I'm a forgiving person. We'll get this guest on eventually because I'm a fan of his. But meanwhile, as Steve Cohen, my producer, who's sitting right next to me, suggested, what did you suggest?
I said, like, how sometimes people talk about how there's a live time and dead time, and we could either make the time dead by saying bitching about this person or complaining, or we could choose from the author to choose yourself, or we could choose to say, hey, let's make this the most productive thing we can do and figure out how do we turn that negative into a positive, turn those lemons into lemonade.
Right. So instead of saying, Sherrod, fuck you. Sherrod, you're always welcome on the show. I hope we can reschedule. And you're a friend and I'm a fan. But you know what I want to talk about? I love talking about cultural events that really teach me about creativity and competence and how much I need to learn to really achieve, you know, to keep on achieving peak performance at what I love to do. And so I love studying everything in art, everything in creativity. I want to talk about what it means to be competent, particularly in the context of the very last concert ever performed by the Beatles. And I don't know how many people know this, but the last concert performed by the Beatles was kind of almost a spur of the moment concert. They were performing for they were in recording sessions for their last album, which was called Let It Be, which had the song Let It Be on it. They were in recording sessions, and just kind of last minute, it was really sort of last day, they said, "Hey, let's just go to the roof, bring up all of our instruments, and just start performing on the fly without telling anybody." And I'm glad I saved the link for myself because I love this so much. I saved the link for myself and made some notes about this concert 6 years ago, pretty much 6 years ago today. And I just clicked on the link just now, and on YouTube it says, there's a black space, and this video contains content from AppleCore and UMG, one or more of whom have blocked it on copyright grounds. So I'm glad I had a chance to watch it. I mean, I probably watched it 100 times at least. And then I wrote down what I learned from it, but I just thought it was such a beautiful concert and has some songs that don't appear on any of their main albums. But the first thing that was so interesting to me is that at the time that they did this album, it was January 30th, 1969 in London. They had been together, I think, about 12 years. They had performed together for not just 1,000 hours, but tens of thousands of hours all over the world at concerts, practicing. I mean, there's a famous story in Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers where they would sometimes perform up to 20 hours a day in Germany before the world even knew who the Beatles were. That's how they got their 10,000 hours in, is that they performed, you know, for so long in every single day in Germany. That's how they really got you know, comfortable with each other, comfortable with their instruments, comfortable with songwriting. So they had performed together for so much. They knew each other so well. Their lives were so intertwined. And yet at this point in January 1969, the band was essentially dead. Like they never performed again in the same room together. They hated each other with a passion. I think at the time, and again, we're doing this podcast on the fly, so feel free to comment or contribute or something on Twitter or whatever. But at the time, Paul McCartney, I believe, was suing the rest of the band over royalties. His Linda McCartney's father was a lawyer, and he was suing the band. George Harrison had at this point, or a few weeks earlier, had quit the band because he was so sick of John Lennon's, you know, trying to dominate the music writing. George Harrison had quit, and he walked out of the recording session saying, see you at the clubs. And the band actually thought of enlisting Eric Clapton to replace George Harrison. Now, George Harrison came back to perform on Let It Be and then to perform on The Rooftop. But that just tells you where the tensions were. And by the way, George Harrison, incredible songwriter. While My Guitar Gently Weeps, My Sweet Lord, these are just amazingly beautiful songs. So, you know, clearly there were a lot of harsh egos involved. Meanwhile, John Lennon was involved in his own stuff. He was starting to record his own independent music. Plus, the band didn't like Yoko Ono. That's infamously didn't like Yoko Ono. There's even a song in this Rooftop concert about John Lennon's love for Yoko Ono, and kind of you could see in the video, I remember seeing they're all sort of laughing at John Lennon when he starts singing this song.
Don't Let Me Down, right?
Let Me Down. You know, which is an interesting song because it's, you know, and this is why I love them as songwriters. You don't really see songs written this any way anymore. Let's just look at all the layers of that phrase, Don't Let Me Down. First off, he's singing it to Yoko Ono, Don't Let Me Down. Like, after he's basically destroyed his relationship with the Beatles because he left his wife for Yoko Ono, he's being vulnerable. He's saying to Yoko Ono, please, you know, don't let me down after all I've done. And, you know, what ended up happening? You know, several years later, he left Yoko Ono for a while and had a relationship with someone else and maybe several other people. And he's saying, don't let me, but I think there's additional layers. He's saying, don't let me down to the Beatles. He thought the Beatles had let him down. He thought their managers had let them down. He thought their producers had let them down. He's saying, don't let me down to the world. Like, he already was feeling distant from the fan base of the Beatles, that they didn't really understand anymore who he was. And ultimately, sadly, he was shot. The world did let him down, you know, about 12 years later. And so I think it's just such a poignant song, and he has so much pain in it. And again, competent professionals, you see while they're singing on the rooftop, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, they're playing it seriously. Paul McCartney is singing, you know, alongside John Lennon, and it's a beautiful, beautiful song. Why do you think that song actually, so Phil Spector, who was producing the album Let It Be, he dropped it from the album, even though it's so beautiful. It later appeared in compilations of the Beatles, but while they were a band, it never appeared on any of their albums, and it only hit number 35 on the charts. It was released on the B-side of Get Back, which was, of course, a beautiful song. Was Get Back written by Ringo Starr, by the way?
I'm going to look it up. Yeah.
Because Ringo Starr wasn't, people always put down Ringo Starr like, oh, he was nobody in the Beatles. But I think he wrote.
He wrote a few. Did he write You Know It Don't Come Easy? You know?
Oh, no. Get Back was written by Paul McCartney. I don't know why. I don't know why I always thought it was written by Ringo Starr. I used to play that as a kid on the piano, and I thought, oh, this is Ringo Starr's one song. But I'm wrong. I just realized now I'm totally wrong. But anyway, Don't Let Me Down was on the B-side of Get Back. And, you know, so what's also interesting is they I think also part of creativity, it's not just that they were so competent together that they could make a song. It's just that they constantly pushed the boundaries of creativity. Instead of just doing a recording session when they all hated each other just to get it over with, they basically, in the middle of winter, January 30th in London, they all went up on the roof and started playing. And so you see in the video, it's so beautiful in the video. I wonder how they got all these video shots, but you see everybody suddenly start on the ground and other office buildings starts looking up. Like, are they live? What's going on? Where's that music coming from? And you see men and women leaving their offices and climbing up fire escapes and standing on rooftops to try to get a peek. And it's just this amazing thing that you wouldn't expect, like, Jay-Z right now to stand up on top of, like, you know, some building in Midtown and start doing a live concert.
Occasionally they do. You know, occasionally even like Jimmy Fallon and I think some of the Roots did like something on the subway, or people will do it, you know, just for that kind of shock value. But I think what attracted you when you wrote about this 6 years ago was just kind of the spontaneity of it and them saying, you know what, let's just go up on the roof, let's do something different. And maybe it was a way to release the tension, to get out of a cramped studio and to do it, you know, and just, it's 45 degrees over there, you know. I also thought about...
But think about what you just said, though. Yeah. It's almost kind of by pushing the boundaries on their creativity by doing this rooftop concert, which they didn't even know if they could pull off. They had to drag all their equipment there. It was freezing cold. It was illegal, which I'll talk about in a second. And... but maybe to diffuse that tension, and that they really did hate each other. It was like sheer hatred. Like, they hated Paul McCartney for suing them. They hated, when I say they, I mean everybody but the guy I mentioned. They hated John Lennon for going with Yoko Ono and doing his own songwriting and trashing their songwriting. They hated George Harrison for just quitting. Right. George Harrison hated them for always acting like they were the songwriters and not him.
Yeah.
I don't think Ringo Starr hated anyone. He was just kind
of... He's probably happy to have been there and happy that he wasn't Pete Best and he was part of it. And it's funny, when we decide to just do this podcast spontaneously, we're not up on a roof and it's not 45 degrees, but I've been recently watching the Ron Howard documentary on the Beatles, and that focused more in the beginning. And in just 5 years, you saw them come up from Liverpool, and they were like brothers, and Ringo Starr said he didn't have any brothers, so these were all like brothers, and they alluded to them working in Hamburg at strip clubs and playing all these hours and just getting real in one room without a bathroom, and how they became so close. And maybe it's inevitable. We've seen enough Behind the Music, you know, about like how these, just the arc of a band where like you get really close and then you kind of resent each other.
Yeah, like very few bands survive for more than like 4 or 5 years, I would say. Like all of my favorite, let's say, older bands don't survive that long. Like, how long did Led Zeppelin survive? Like, their peaks were just like maybe 5 years, and then Robert Plant was off on his own, Jimmy Page was off on his own. Now the Rolling Stones, they're still going strong and they've been around since 1961, but even the Rolling Stones, they kind of hate each other. Keith Richards has trashed Mick Jagger in his book, and you know, Charlie Watts was always kind of distant. And
Well, I just feel like it's kind of like when you see Richard Ben Kramer, what it takes, like what kind of ego does it take to run for president? What kind of ego does it take to kind of get up there and be a band and to think you could accomplish all this and to
That's an interesting thing. Sorry to keep interrupting, Steve.
No,
you know I'm an interrupter on the podcast.
Yes, obviously.
But that's an interesting thing too, and we've seen this on the podcast. Like, who was it who said it? I think it was Paul Reiser who said it, that when you're in the beginning of when you're at the very beginning of an arc that's going to be great, like the Beatles were obviously from 1957 to 1961 when they were on their first arc, you're almost protected, like in the womb, from knowing that you're not great yet. And because if they had just started playing and said, you know what, we suck, they would have just stopped.
Right,
but instead, they didn't know. They probably already thought they were great, at least good enough to perform in Hamburg and go on the road and team up. They probably barely learned. I mean, it's like the Rolling Stones. When the Rolling Stones started, Mick Jagger didn't know how to do anything. He just loved the blues mixed with rock. And there's another point there, which is none of these people, whenever you hear anyone who's great, like whether it's the Beatles or Jay-Z, we just mentioned, or the Rolling Stones, or, you know, pick your favorite athlete, it's never by themselves. They all grow up as what I'll call a scene. You know, so when a great story is when Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, you know, I guess it was Brian Epstein told them, you know, you guys need to start writing your own music instead of doing covers. you know, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were all day trying to figure out a song to write, and they just couldn't do it. So they took a walk. Who did they run into? But John Lennon and Paul McCartney,
wow,
who they knew, they all knew each other since they were teenagers because they all were hanging out at the same skiff clubs in London when nobody was anybody then. And they said to John Lennon and Paul McCartney, hey, we're having a real hard time coming with our first song. So John Lennon and Paul McCartney went upstairs with them and wrote, wow, the Rolling Stones' first original song with, you know, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. So when people, so that's another great example. Like, you can't be the best in the world simply by yourself. You grow up as find your teammates, yeah, find your Justice League of America.
Well, speaking of which, you know, like in that same Ron Howard documentary, and I was very intrigued with it. Obviously, Ron Howard always, you know, brilliant guy, and he was very successful, and even now he's like profiling. It's not meant to be a commercial for Ron Howard, but if you appreciate it, Ron, please come.
And by the way, we've had Brian Grazer on the podcast. That was a great one where he describes how he meets, yes, Ron Howard.
Yeah, and we also loved your book, Curious Mind, and we're waiting to see your book called Eye Contact, which, you know, again, we'll leave the light on for you like Tom Baudet. He was very intrigued by the Beatles in the same way that he was intrigued by, like, the astronauts, because they were these guys up in a shuttle and they were the whole world and them. You know, I think there were so many things that were fascinating about it. But in that, you know, McCartney and Lennon wrote so many songs together and they found their kindred spirit. They found somebody who shared his passion for it. And Paul McCartney talked about how when they were 15 or 16, he'd always go to parties and he would say, hey, I'm a songwriter. And people like, oh, what'd you think of the football game? And then he was like, John Lennon, he met a kindred spirit who was like, I love writing songs too. And he had somebody who could kind of, you know, challenge him and really help him.
And it's interesting because, yeah, no one would ever say, I don't know anyone who ever says they were the best guitar players.
Sure.
I don't know anyone who says Ringo Starr is the best drummer ever.
Well, we saw Quincy Jones recently gave an infamous interview where he said they were terrible musicians and how Ringo Starr was horrible and they would replace him with people. But obviously, you know, if you ask the Beatles when they were at the Cavern Club in the 60s and they were doing their thing, you know, Paul McCartney talked about how he had goosebumps when Ringo Starr came in and what that transformed them. And that was kind of the missing link. So, yeah, there's always an alchemy with these kind of groups and these people. And
But it's, yeah, important, again, to find your scene. Like, you know, people think of Andy Warhol as this very singular, unique artist, but at the time he was competing with Roy Lichtenstein, other artists who were trying to kind of get the pop art, you know, sure, king title. He was competing against the last generation of, you know, Jasper Johns and all these artists. And, you know, he had to find his unique thing, but he was still growing up in this scene. You can't remove yourself from the scene ever. And you see this in stand-up comedy, like, you know, who was performing at the Comedy Store in the 70s? Robin Williams, Jay Leno, David Letterman, you know, and probably most of the comedians who went on to great, great heights. It was their scene. They bring each other together. Even they're competitive. Like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones obviously are very competitive. They also grow up together.
I enjoyed the Steven Spielberg documentary because they talked about him in the 70s and it was him, Brian De Palma, Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, and you know how...
And George Lucas saved, yeah, Spielberg, right? Yes, like Spielberg, yes, was coming off some failures.
The movie 1941, which he tried doing a comedy with John Belushi and it didn't work and he was kind of in director's jail and Lucas invited him on to Indiana Jones. And it kind,
yeah,
of
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of funny too, like, I always think there's always elements of society that don't really appreciate when something amazing is happening around them. Like, so the Beatles are coming onto the rooftop for this last concert ever, and it's maybe their most beautiful concert because by then they had so much experience and there's all these new songs. And one guy who was, you know, everybody was wandering into the streets trying to listen, climbing up on rooftops, but one guy said, it's a bit of an imposition to absolutely disrupt all of the business in this area. And I always wonder, where is that guy today? Like, what is that guy's name? And what's he doing right now? Is he still alive? Like,
yeah,
he's famous for basically trashing the best concert ever. And who is he? And the Beatles are the Beatles.
Sure, for sure. I mean, it's probably the version of the troll right now, or...
That someone know? Always has. Yes. And then someone called the police too. Like wow. The police. So while they were singing Get Back, the police started gathering on the roof. And let me see if I can find.
The police wanted them to get back.
Basically, so McCartney says, he riffs. He just makes it up in the middle of the song in Get Back. You've been playing on the roofs again, and you know your mama doesn't like it. She's going to have you arrested. And meanwhile, the police are just, they're waiting for their moment. And, you know, I don't know. I just think it's like, it's interesting. Like a creator can never rest. Like no matter what, they're always trying to push some envelope, no matter what's happening in their lives.
Sure. And well, I was going to say a few things. I mean, one, you like to remark when Ice-T, you asked Ice-T if he kind of sat back. I'll let you say it, but what did you learn from Ice-T about like relevance and...
Yeah, so I remember I was on Ice-T's podcast a few years ago, and I before we started, we were just hanging out, and I asked him, if you stopped performing, stopped appearing on TV, stopped going on tour, how long would it take before people would stop talking about you? And his answer surprised me. He said 6 months, which I thought was like, oh my gosh, this is Ice-T. He's been one of my hip-hop heroes for 20 years, for 30 years. And he thinks in just, I mean, I remember him on the movie Breakin' in 1983 or 82. That's where his first appearance was. And I watched that movie over and over. If he thinks just 6 months, what does it mean for the rest of creatives? but it also goes to show you too that we now live in such a fragmented creative, but also much more creative world. There's so many different forms for creativity that A, I think you can be forgotten pretty quickly, but B, if you do something good, it doesn't matter how long you've been out of the limelight, people will know and pick it up. Like the Beatles have had many bad, horrible songs. I just can't tell you the names of any of them. But all they had to do was do another good song, and then boom, they're back to number one.
Sure. And, you know, we just mentioned George Lucas. I mean, some people didn't like the prequels to Star Wars, you know, or any person who, like, comes out with a lot of movies. You do remember the hits, and maybe that's obviously encouragement to just keep on going. And there's a kind of, like, combination of factors that lead to success or critical acclaim, and you know, so I just think you have to just keep creating, like you said.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
It's an interesting balance between being prolific, well, you know, basically the whole quantity versus quality argument. I think quality is obviously the things people remember, but I think quantity is important because out of that you get practice, you get experience, and you have the opportunity for 1 out of 10 songs, books, articles, whatever it is you do, to be super high quality. And it's a comfort knowing that people won't remember the 9 out of 10 that might be horrible, but they will remember the quality. I always go back and forth on this because too much quantity could ruin your opportunity to just sit back and take a breather. So it's, I wrestle with this all the time. I mean, I went through a phase of about 6 or 7 years where I was writing, actually even longer than that, more like 16 years when you include my earlier finance writing. But let's say 6 years where I was writing every day. I mean, I have in my archives something like 2,500 articles. And, you know, it's, but I do think it's important sometimes to take a breather. I don't know.
Well, it also, I think people kind of like discipline themselves to work every day and to do things every day. And I imagine like what I think intrigued you about this last concert, that you were fixated on it because you could relate to certain things about it. But I think obviously all these great writers or composers, they don't always enjoy it, you know, but it's easier when you enjoy it and maybe, you know, you're not even realizing it. It's a habit like that you really enjoy doing it every day. That's why you're doing it. You're doing it for the sake of doing it. You're doing art for this art's sake rather than any other reasons, right? I mean, isn't that what motivates most of these people to do it? I mean,
but then the question is, so they all went off to do their own individual things, but I would say still probably their best work ever was with when they were with the Beatles. And so, like, take Paul McCartney. I mean, maybe he would argue, and I wouldn't argue with Paul McCartney on anything musical, but arguably his best, many people would probably think his best work was with the Beatles. How do you think someone like that is still creative, but deals with the fact that his best work was 40 or 50 years ago?
Well, I think like a couple of things. I know, like, one of our favorites, Judy Blume, you know, I think, like, whenever she sees people, they always talk about her old books, and then
from
people,
the 70s.
Yeah, but then people are like, what are you gonna write? Kids are young. Some people are always like, what's your next book? You know, or, you know, and so, I think that's a hard, I think we all have to live in the present and hope that you're gonna, you know, get better and just keep producing quality work. And, you know, we can name a ton of people who produced work that may not be as impactful as the other stuff, but it's still really excellent, and they enjoy doing it. That's why they're doing it. You know,
yeah, I mean,
it's
like, Bob Dylan writes in his memoir Chronicles that he was doing an album in the late 80s. Now, he hadn't done any successful work since the 60s, but he did this album in the late 80s that he knew in advance was going to be horrible. Like, just people were not interested in that music. He even said he was interested in hip hop and other kinds of music, but he was still trying to do stuff that was creative to what how he wanted to pursue creativity. And he ended up producing a failed album, but it was still what was moving his own personal creativity forward without caring necessarily whether it was going to be a hit or not.
Well, you know, we had Don McLean who created, you know,
American Pie.
And that, you know, that's one of the most successful songs of all time, and he's still known for it, and he still at close to 70 or, you know, around 70 is creating new things. And I also, you know, and it's something you've talked about with Ryan Holiday, how even after posthumously, some things are appreciated more. So I don't think creative people are thinking just right in the moment as much. And look at anybody. You can mention, you know, Julie Louis-Dreyfus. Like, she'll never be known for something more than Seinfeld or Saturday Night Live. And then Veep is a very good show. Or Ted Danson will be known for Cheers. And then Becker comes, and it's still a credible show. And people, if you've never seen those other ones, you would like whatever he was working on, or Bored to Death, or other things. So I feel like we all have to do the best we can at that time, regardless if, you know, our best days may be behind us, or, you know, the zenith of creativity, and, you know, you have to do the most with what you have at that time. What other choice do you have?
Yeah, and also I think, you know, personal improvement happens no matter what. So if you feel people get satisfaction, not necessarily from millions of people liking their work, but if they feel like they themselves are personally improving. And I think, you know, that's what a lot of, you know, artists and creatives and musicians and writers and so on, you know, have to keep in mind, is that that's a big source of pleasure, is sensing your own improvement, whether or not it's hitting the entire world. Because we live in such a granular world now where, you know, we were talking the other day, all of us in here, including Jay, the audio engineer, about there are apparently teams for computer games, video games. Like, this shows how out of date I am, and
how Jay is video game athletes.
There's a $24 million prize pool in the latest, like, video game tournament. I'm and this is a bigger business than tennis and golf combined. Like, I'm incredibly surprised, but And so it must have 100 million fans at least. And yet I'm not one of them. I think at the time, everybody in the world was a fan of the Beatles. Everybody in the world was a fan of, you know, whoever was the top bands or artists or writers then. And now it's so granular. Like, okay, I've got my 5 people I like on YouTube, my 5 podcasts I like, my 5 blogs I like, my 5 writers I like. And you'll have your set. But there's so many more outlets to be creative. You know, is there anything else you want to add?
I wanted to say, among other things, I was going to probably bring up 2 things. One, I always liked how Eddie Murphy really admired Paul McCartney, because he said, like, who were bigger than the Beatles ever? Like, who had more fame, more opportunity for decadence? And, you know, and if you look at Paul McCartney now, even, he seems very sane, very normal, and whatever normal is. I mean, I guess that it's like kind of like that line, the definition of normal, someone you don't know very well. But he could have been like Elvis. Like, he could have, you know, and dying at 42 and shooting television sets and, you know, really get caught up in excess. So, and I think somebody like Eddie Murphy, who seems to, you know, we talked about this with Tony Rock, seems to have kind of been like not afraid of not being able to duplicate his earlier, you know, success. You know, he didn't get up at the Saturday Night Live stuff. He didn't host the Oscars. And, you know, and it's something where just even just going out there and doing it is pretty amazing. And, you know, that was one thing I always found. I'm wondering what you think about that. Like, you know, just the ability to achieve all that earthly kind of success and yet remain kind of like Rudyard Kipling, you know?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, there's a saying about wealth, which is that wealth doesn't, you know, having a lot of money suddenly doesn't change you. It just brings out what was already inside of you and magnifies it. So somebody who was meant to shoot television sets and go crazy, that probably was already inside of them, and just sheer wealth and excess allowed him to do that. And Paul McCartney probably deep down was a very, you know, put together person. You know, John Lennon had his own things inside of him. George Harrison had a more spiritual side. So, you know, his original songs like My Sweet Lord are very beautiful and almost spiritual. Ringo Starr was more low-key. So even with massive wealth, he's remained more or less low-key. But I think it's interesting just the focus on competence, the focus on always stretching the boundaries of creativity, always trying to improve. And, you know, and I think they didn't let, not letting personal tensions get in the way of your creativity, because ultimately people remember the rooftop concert for the music, not for, no, most people don't even know kind of the nuances of how much they hated each other at this point. And I just want to close this one. First off, I want to say, if you like this kind of podcast where we sort of analyze something and how it's affected us and our analysis of this, let me know on Twitter. I'm at Jay Altucher, and, you know, tweet about this or tweet anything that I might be missing, or if you disagree with anything. The other thing is, I think, you know, we're always stretching our creativity, trying to find different formats for this podcast. We're starting a YouTube channel about the podcast, kind of a post-game analysis and other YouTube channels. So we're always looking at different ways of doing things. But I want to end with the most important thing I think the Beatles always had, which is, you know, the so-called beginner's mind. The idea that the best way to, you know, always the person on the steepest part of the learning curve is the beginner. And so if you can keep beginner's mind always, you'll always be on the steep, no matter where you are on the real learning curve, you'll always feel like it's super steep, and you'll find the places where it could be super steep for you and improve the best. And I think at the very end of this, at the end of this concert, the police are all surrounding them. They have to shut it down. It's freezing cold. They've been playing for a half hour. By the way, you can't even find the YouTube video now, so maybe there's some way that it can come out. Is the rooftop concert on the Ron Howard documentary?
I don't think it was. I mean, I think I don't remember being in there.
You can know? See yeah. clips of it. Like, if you search yeah. Don't Let Me Down, you
yeah.
can see
clips. They had the Candlestick concert, you know, it, in there. Yeah.
But, So they're about to lay their instruments down for the last time in their lives together. And John Lennon, the last line the Beatles ever say to an audience, John Lennon says, "On behalf of the group and ourselves, I hope we pass the audition."
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.